So that's what I had. I'm happy to answer any questions or, what do you think?
Yeah. So why does binding up particles on the surface of the virus prevent infection?
Well, that's a very good question. Yeah. So, you know, doodles always show up in groups and so forth. If you don't know, this is my sister, and she's a clinician. So these little orange things, they're required for attachment to the epithelial cells of the gut lining. And so the thinking is that the antibodies would inhibit that binding to those epithelial cells. That would be one mechanism of potential clearance, or I should say prevention of infection, prevention of adhesion to their target cell, because like I said, in my view, a virus is not alive. It needs to get inside its target cell to generate progeny. So probably some of our effective viral vaccines are preventing viruses from attaching to their target cell. So by having the antibody to this thing here, the thinking would be prevent. Now, there could be other mechanisms. I don't think they'll ever be able to prove, because whatever the mechanism might be, if it does work, because it's all going to have to be done in the human, and you just can't go in and do really a lot of the definitive experiments. So how's that for? Okay. Yeah.
What's your view on inoculations causing autism?
Okay, that was Lancet's study that generated a considerable amount of concern in the use of vaccines, and that has been shown to be a fraudulent study. Cooked up data, all authors except for the one individual that really kind of went through the public press and so forth on that. There is no direct data in support of that concern. Tremendous amount of time and effort and resources has gone into that aspect. This generated a lot of the concern of the use of vaccines and led to parents making the decision to not vaccinate their kids. That study is a fraudulent, retracted study. There's no other data out there in that context. This is not to say that we didn't generate vaccines over the years that didn't have side effects. I mean, the early vaccines that they had to generate for polio and so forth, because of that tremendous impact of that disease, some of the early vaccines that went into the population, they didn't have the sufficient time and so forth to really identify any potential safety issue, and they ended up fine. We have generated vaccine preps that have had some side effects over the years and so forth. But once those have been identified, those vaccines have been modified and shown to be incredibly safe, but they'll never be 100%. There will always be, you know, some frequency, but you've got to weigh that against the impact of the disease. So I'm going to give you guys, to me it was a horror story. So rotavirus is very similar to norovirus. And it leads to hundreds of thousands of deaths in developing countries. It's an enteric virus, primarily in kids. There was a very effective vaccine developed in the early 90s, but that was kind of the peak of this concern of vaccines. Companies were incredibly reluctant to jump into this arena because of litigation concerns and so forth. That vaccine did have a certain side effect. It caused an obstructive disease, bowel disease in some patients at a very low frequency, and they never really understood that. But because of the litigious nature of our country and the context, and these companies are in this country, they pulled the vaccine off the market. Very effective vaccine. Think about that. Now, those kids, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids die each year that vaccine wasn't used. And so weigh that, if it's 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 10,000 and you got 100,000 kids dying. So we have slowed up vaccine development. And what this country did was they developed a mechanism to reduce that liability for pharmaceutical companies so they would jump back into the array, because companies were running the other way because it would destroy a company with that. So this vaccine concern really has led to a lot of overreaction. And parents that have made this decision, and they're very conscientious, they've done their homework, they go through the web, they don't vaccinate their kids, they are violating one of the key things for a vaccine program to work within a population, is that when I give a vaccine, if I gave you guys all a vaccine, there'd be a spectrum of responses. Some of you wouldn't get a great response. Some of you would get a moderate response. Some of you get a robust response. Obviously, the robust response is the most effective, but to protect society or the population at large, we've got to vaccinate at least 80% of you. It's called herd immunity, in order for the vaccine program to be effective. So when people make the decision not to vaccinate, it's not simply making the decision for their kids. They're starting to then impact the herd immunity rule. And now you'll see outbreaks of measles. You see outbreaks of whooping cough. You see, it's rather striking. What happens when that number of vaccinated individuals in a population just gets below the threshold. And that's what those, you know, the concerns have led to. It's tough to, because you can't do the definitive experiment, but it doesn't look like that. Even in a natural infection, it's a real long-lasting immunity. I fully expect, even though I had neuro 5 years ago or whatever it was, next time in Vegas, I'll probably get it again. But within, you know, maybe within a year or two after my exposure, I probably was immune. And they're hoping in the context of the vaccine, it would be more effective. Yeah?
I'm thinking of like a terrorist. And in fact, you talk about people with B cells, people who are immunologically compromised. I'm thinking maybe for Hodgkin lymphoma. But is it possible to look at the kinds of B cells that a population has as predominant? I mean, can you identify what those are so that some, so that would somebody, a bad guy, be able to say, okay, this population genetically does not have this particular B-cell, so we'll work on
we can go in and identify B-cells in the nature of the antibody, you know, that binding domain. That can be done. But for what you're describing in the context of antibody molecules, it's not really the case. The antibody, that diversity, that repertoire of antibodies that we make, it's all done randomly. And each of our repertoires are a little different, but they're so immense. We are all pretty equal in what we're able to generate a response to. And I don't think you could ever go in and really define something within a group of people that they just don't make that mirror image. However, There are certain things, certain features that make for the defining term we use for these signatures in immunology is an antigen. There are certain things about an antigen that are required for the immune system to respond. So the examples I normally use are proteins. We generate a great response against proteins, but we don't generate good responses against carbohydrates. We don't generate good responses against lipids and so forth. And so there are things that within our immune system we just naturally don't respond to. So that exists. But again, I don't see that as a real advantage in your scenario. But we do have examples when we talk about the cell response. I told you antibodies response and cellular response. The cellular response requires what's called MHC molecules in our body to present the foreign signature to the cells that will mount the cellular response. Okay? Our MHC defines each and every one of us. It's what makes us unique. It makes it so that my heart can't be transplanted into you. It's my MHC is different than your MHC. Well, MHC evolved differently in different regions of the world. And that was under selective pressures, because these MHC molecules are required to present signatures to our immune system in certain regions of the world, because of the microbes people lived in, there was a selection for MHC that might preferentially present signatures of a given virus that might be unique to, let's say, Africa. Ah, there's the end of my... And we see this around the world, that based upon the microbes we evolved with, we selected for different MHC molecules that would more effectively present signatures unique to those microbes. Regions that didn't have those microbes, their MHC were not as effective because there was no selection. So when smallpox was introduced into the Americas, it was not effectively presented to the immune system of the people here, and that's why it just went rampant through the populations. And we have other examples. So the Spanish brought back Bordetella from South America back to Europe, and there was no selection. And so Bordetella was worse in Europe than it was in the Americas. So we have these examples. So on the cellular response within populations, we know that that occurs. The antibody response, not so much. Kind of a long-winded answer to your question. So, yes?
So is there a potential to have a vaccine for everything? Every virus, bacteria?
A single? No. You have to have one for every single bug. This is the unfortunate thing for drug development. If you're focusing on vaccines, you have to focus on each and every bug sequentially. And so, you know, from research through development, and this is probably one of the faster examples with Ligacyte, it's still probably going to be 15 years if it works and gets onto the market. You got to do that for each and every bug. Now, one example that goes a little counter to that is in the context of influenza. So, you know, you're all taking your influenza vaccines each year, and that's due to a very subtle change that occurs in the virus very easily. They're called point mutations. And each vaccine we get each year, they try to predict that change. Okay? But what they're trying to do for the bad scenario, and the bad scenario is what's called a pandemic, and the changes that occur that lead to a pandemic are not just single little point mutations, it's big changes in the virus. So they want to come up with a vaccine that could target something common to more than just a single influenza strain. So there's a goal within a class of pathogens of doing that. You can't do it between different pathogens, except for by the approach. And there's a real slick approach for generating a vaccine that might target multiple bugs. And one of the cool ways to target the immune system is to use the bug. The bug is pretty good at really firing up the immune system. A bug that's really good at that is Salmonella. So when we take in Salmonella, not only does it make us sick, it really fires up our immune system. So what people have tried, we don't have it in the human yet, but we can do it in animal studies and so forth, is take Salmonella, attenuate it so it's not going to cause diarrhea, and now take the signatures of different bugs. And this is pretty easy to do. You just take the gene that encodes the signature for Brucella, take the gene that encodes the signature for Yersinia, take the gene that encodes the signature for Francisella, and put them all into the Salmonella genome. So now the Salmonella makes a signature of a Francisella, makes a signature of a Brucella, makes a signature of Yersinia. And now it comes in, and maybe we'll have a multivalent vaccine against those different bugs. So that setting you could do it, but across the spectrum, no, it won't work. And so that's where you're talking about antimicrobial drugs, or you're trying to come up with ways to make our innate defenses work better. Because our innate defenses aren't specific. If we can make our innate defenses work better for this bug, more than likely will work better for this bug. So hopefully that answers your question. Yeah.
If I understand you right, in order to ever develop, let's say, an antibody to a microorganism, you have to be born with at least one B cell that can do it.
Yes.
Are there any instances of infectious agents that are known to to which there's never been the ability to make antibody by anyone?
You know, it's not because of their signatures. It may be some unique feature of the virus or whatever that it hides from the immune system. It doesn't really generate the response. But as long as their proteins are foreign, and they should be, we have an antibody that can be made. It does not mean the antibody is effective, right? So let's use HIV as an example. You know, and it was kind of a misnomer in the early years that the immune system couldn't engage HIV. No, it can. You get a whopping antibody response. In fact, that's the diagnostic test. Go in, if you've been exposed to the virus, they look for antibodies. But as we all know, in that virus, we're not clearing it from the body. We're knocking it back. We're making it hide. But unfortunately, it hides in one of our immune cells and starts to kill it, and then we'll get transitioned to AIDS in that setting. But we're making a lot of antibody. In fact, it's very robust antibody in that setting. It's just not providing that sterilizing immunity. So those examples occur. The other example that occurs in the context of we can have lots of antibodies, if we look at something like TB or leprosy, this bacteria, it gets inside our cells called macrophages. And so to get rid of this bacteria, we have to trigger a response that's called a Th1 response. I won't tell you what that is. It's just, trust me, that's a type of an immune response that's needed to get rid of something that's inside our cells. Okay? Antibodies don't work inside our cells. So that Th1 response, we really don't care about the antibodies. In the clinic, there are patients that have disseminated leprosy instead of the granuloma form. Granuloma form is the beneficial form. That's what we want. Th1s generate granuloma around the bug. The people that have problems are the disseminated leprosy. And in that setting, those patients, instead of generating Th1 response, they generate bucket loads of antibody. And the antibody is actually a benefit to the bug. And that's the problem in those patients. Their immune system generated the wrong response, lots of antibodies, and it absolutely is not beneficial to the patient. But back to your very first question. If it's a foreign antigen, we got an antibody there. We just got to get that B cell expanded. And so viruses, they come up with ways to kind of certain that measles suppresses our cell proliferation. And so there's been selection for preventing expansion of the cells, but the cells are there. I can't think of an example where we didn't find antibodies against a given bug. Yeah?
Two-part question. One is, what is your opinion about this fear of a pandemic, that influenza virus makes the final, or several mutations are necessary for that? And secondly, are we developing rapid enough response rates for developing vaccines against that potential pandemic within the short period of time?
Yeah, the work on influenza is really amazing. And the effort, and you know, it's a pretty amazing story how the CDC can monitor the changes in the viruses that particularly that come out of Asia and then will make their way to the U.S. with sufficient time to generate these our yearly vaccines. But the pandemic one, nature has given us enough lessons on this that it's going to occur again. You know, we just had the recent outbreak that occurred originated out of Mexico and moved up. And what happens that leads to these pandemics is that influenza viruses not only infect us, they infect animals. And there are influenza viruses that are specific to a given animal. It might be a bird, turkey, or chickens. And there's influenza viruses that are in swine. And there's influenza viruses that are in us. The virus that we're worried about down the road, and in my opinion, it's just inevitable, are the viruses that find themselves, we have a human virus, very good at infectivity, but doesn't make us that sick. We've got an animal virus, can't infect us, but it's very virulent, very pathogenic. They get into the pig, they get into the same cell, and then there's mixing of the genetic material. And this is what leads to this big change in the virus, and the virus that comes out now has the potential of the infectivity of the original human virus. The virulence of the animal virus, there's the concern. So what happened in the Mexico, the swine flu that came out, was it acquired incredible human infectivity, but the virulence wasn't really that bad. Bird flu that's out there, its infectivity is really low, but it's something, I don't know, 60% death rate when people do get that. So there's an isolate that has incredible virulence, low infectivity. The concern is, what if that virus finds itself in the same cell as just a run-of-the-mill influenza virus that's really infective, and they recombine? And just statistically, it's almost inevitable. I tell my WAMI students, they're going to be at the front of this battle. You know, it's happened, the Spanish flu, what did it kill? 50 million people? We had a pandemic in the 70s. We've had the smaller pandemics. It's occurred. We're just worried about the real bad one, where virulence is high, infectivity is high, and it's going to probably occur at some time. So our hope is we'll have the vaccine already made that has the potential to work against something that we haven't had to deal with yet. And that's what that research effort is really focused on in influenza. But yeah, I think it's inevitable. And why does it come out of Asia? Huge population, close proximity to animals. That's the reason that statistically it'll come out of Asia. Yeah?
So I'm not sure I understand this infection mechanism. There's proteins on the outside of the virus.
Right.
And you said they attach to the outside of the cell.
Right.
Do we need another set to get it into the cell?
Yeah, you know, how a virus gets into a cell, there will be some differences in what triggers then the movement of the virus into the cell. It can be as simple as following attachment. So our cell membrane is actually fluid. It's got a lipid bilayer, and there's some proteins in it. But it's a fluid membrane. And so the viral particle can bind and just kind of, way to describe it, kind of melt into that membrane, and then deliver its nucleic acid into the cell. Now its genetic information is in the cell. Now that it's going to take advantage of the cell machinery to generate the viral proteins. And there's nothing unique about it. It just gets in the line with all of our self proteins being made, and we start generating viral proteins. And what's amazing, this is why you got to get Mark Young to come give a talk. When the viral nucleic acids encode and lead to the generation of viral proteins, these proteins self-assemble into those particles. And then they'll get loaded with nucleic acid, and then there's a budding phenomenon, or the cell gets lysed, and then the progeny are released in that setting. So that's kind of a simplistic description that probably is true of all viruses, but each mechanism might be a little different on how they're getting in and then how they get out. Because there's viruses that get out without ever killing their host cell, but other viruses kill their host cell.
Well, you said you could attack it by not letting it attach.
Right.
Can you attack it by not letting it get in?
I would bet a lot of our antibodies prevent maybe the fusion to the cell membrane. In fact, some of the early HIV vaccine attempts were to generate antibodies that would prevent that fusion of the virus to the cell membrane. So that would be a mechanism of potential protection. There's probably lots of different ones. I use the attachment one because it's the easiest one to explain. But any mechanism that is dictated by a protein that is considered foreign to us, we can make an antibody to that and potentially disrupt that mechanism.
So, if you're making flu vaccines,
yeah,
need one for H1N2 and one for H7N8 and all that
yeah.
stuff. But do they have the same mechanism for getting into the cell?
So that is some of the research that's going on, this goal of getting a vaccine that could hit multiple isolates of influenza, they're trying to hit a common mechanism. Most of the vaccines are hitting the hemagglutinin and the neuraminidase. Those are the things that are changing on this virus. But yeah, the goal is find that common mechanism that, let's say, most of the isolates use, use that as the vaccine. And that's tremendous amount of research effort on that. Yeah, and there's tremendous potential for that to work. Yeah?
Do you feel these antibacterial swipes and salts and so forth do a lot of
good? Yeah, you're getting me into a lot of... So I don't shy away from being on one side of a debate. So I believe in the hygiene hypothesis. And when I say that, people initially think that I believe in the real value of these soaps and so forth. No, I believe in the opposite. That we have problems in developed countries associated with asthma, allergic reactions, and so forth. That one of the theories is called the hygiene hypothesis, that we now live in too clean of an environment. Our immune system evolved in a dirty environment. And we know for a fact that as we age, after we're born, the environment contributes to the development of our immune system. What's in our gut contributes to the development of our immune system, the microbes that are in our gut, the dirt that we eat, and so forth. And so the use of antimicrobial soaps all the time and other things that have led to very clean environments and so forth, we're not educating our immune system the same way we did 60 years ago, 70 years ago, and so forth. And it's probably leading to some of this misregulation of the immune system and these disorders. But now back to the point where I have to... So that's my view. I think there was an advantage of living in a immunologically dirty environment. But now, let's fast forward to now, and let's talk about norovirus. How do we don't have a vaccine yet, right? It's just being tested and so forth, but norovirus is here, right? And how do we deal with it? Well, the best countermeasures are proper sanitation and proper hygiene. And that is the use of, you know, washing your hands and the antimicrobial soaps and so forth. They need to be done. But there, you know, over time in our society, we're living in a much cleaner environment than we were 60 years ago, and we're seeing the consequences of it. So my son's got really bad asthma, and my daughter's got bad allergies and so forth, and she lived in a little cleaner environment than I did. That's right. And so the hygiene, the sanitation and so forth for dealing with noro, so on cruise ships, nursing homes and so forth, this is what you have to do right now because we don't have the vaccines. We don't have, you know, the effective antiviral and so forth. You have to use that approach. So yeah, it's kind of a wishy-washy answer.
Well, it's almost 1:30. We've kept the good professor away from his research long enough. I'm sure he'll stick around and ask a question, answer a question or two if you have another one. But let's thank the Jutillas for coming and giving us a great presentation.